This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name, as always, is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Brent Bowers, and we're going to be diving into a topic that I feel is really underserved, at least in the real estate investing realm, which is raw land investing. You know, we always like to think about these big, sexy investments. People talk up investing in apartment complexes and buying all these, you know, rental houses and, you know, stuff that gets all the traction on, you know, TikTok and Instagram and Twitter. But, you know, rarely do we ever kind of look at, you know, the, you know, what all real estate is built on, which is the dirt underneath of it. And the fact that this can actually be a viable investment for you, not only to make some money, but make good money at that. So Brent, thank you so much for being on with us today to talk about this. You know, I'll be the first to admit I've had a lack of hands-on experience in this in my investing career. You know, early on, I did some investing for clients and I've done some adjacent raw land deals, but as far as the nuts and bolts and really kind of the strategy behind it, you know, I'm very happy to have you on today. So give us a little bit of background about yourself. I know you certainly have kind of an interesting background with being in the armed services and kind of how you came to be, you know, at the point you are in today with focusing on raw land, especially in today's climate.
Yeah. Thanks, Alex, for having me on the Alternative Investing Podcast. I like to go against the, I like to do the opposite of what the herd is doing. And I just want to mention, here's a huge win for me. Four days ago, I just realized I had a little Facebook memory pop up, was the last day that I worked for the military. So six years ago, 4 days ago marked the 6 year mark. So 6 years, I haven't had a real job. I have been home with my family, no longer being told what to do, how to dress, how to look, get a haircut every week. Here's where you're deploying for the next year. You won't see your family for over, you know, the next 8 months, or you got to sleep in the field for the next 3 weeks. That is all over. I wanted freedom. I wanted lifestyle freedom. I wanted financial freedom. And I just want everyone to know, like, it doesn't take as much as we think it will take to get that financial freedom. My background was military. I was in the military. I started out in real estate. I wanted to be in real estate in 2004, since the time I graduated high school. I was reading all the Donald Trump books, The Art of the Deal, all these things. And I will say I probably was not successful in real estate until about 2015 timeframe, 2014. So if you do the math, that's like 11 years. So anybody listening to this is like, man, it's just not working for me. I've been trying out for 6 or 8 weeks. I've been trying it out for 6 months or 6 years. Keep doing it. Keep failing forward. Keep taking the action. So that's a little bit about me. I left my W-2 job about 6 years ago, and I've been living off passive income from my land investing. Now, granted, it's not all passive. There's some work involved with it. We're always feeding the beast, you know, refilling the machine, oiling the machine, maintaining the machine, servicing the machine. The machine for me is real estate.
Sure. Now, it's kind of an interesting point that you bring up. And I always like to kind of focus on, you know, it's a good point of saying failing forward. You know, don't stagnate. But a lot of people, especially in real estate, you know, I've had a few that I think one of my last guests where we talked about, I was investing in short line railroads, which I found fascinating. The episode hasn't come up yet, but shameless plug for the podcast. If you want to learn about how to buy and sell railroads, great interview. But he was one of the few people that actually came out of college and started directly doing real estate investing. And it's always kind of an interesting trajectory. We have so many people in the real estate realm that come from so many diverse backgrounds, whether that's work, whether that's, you know, serving our country in the armed services, whether that's having a whole other career path and then changing gears and then being in real estate. But you said back in 2004 is kind of when you got the itch to do it. And it took you, you know, the better part of a little bit longer than a decade to really kind of find some success. So maybe let's, before we jump into kind of your investing philosophy, what happened, and you said about 2015, that really kind of, you know, what started to click? What wasn't working? And then, you know, what few things could you say that changed in about 2015 that really helped lead you to some success in this realm?
Great question, Alex. And it was, I had a huge why. But let me tell you, I had no clue what my why was. I didn't define it that way because everyone's always talking about what's your why, you know, define your why. I didn't do any of that. That was too deep for me. You know, I'm a knuckle dragger. I was in the military. I just knew that I no longer wanted to be away from my family all the time. You know, I served 8.5 years in the military. I already had one divorce from being gone for so much, so often. And granted, you know, I probably wasn't the perfect husband when I was home because I was so focused on what I had to do for the military. I just knew I needed to get away from that. I was preparing for my third combat deployment. Me and my new wife at that time, she's barely newlywed in 2015, just had her first baby. And I knew I needed to change something very quickly before, divorce number two happened. And I just saw it was coming. Like, you know, I was leaving again, leaving her with the child. And, you know, it wasn't my fault I was leaving, but I knew I had to change something. So I started searching for answers, started listening to podcasts like the Alternative Investing Podcast. I became a student anytime I was driving in my car to and from work. And I did one extra step. I wrote down the action step that I was going to take, and I immediately took that action that day. And I heard about land investing, and I had never heard anybody else talking about that. I had already purchased rental properties. I had wholesaled a couple houses to help pay for college, and this was all haphazard. You know, I didn't create a system with any of it. But when I heard the guy talking about land investing, I was like, I've never heard this before. I want to avoid the herd mentality because the herd gets slaughtered. They all go off the cliff. I want to go the opposite way. So I immediately started mailing tax delinquent landowners. And I did that consistently. And I answered the phone consistently. And I started working through the process. Now, I made a ton of mistakes. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, I was buying land for super cheap and selling it for more. I was making profit. And then I started seller financing the land, selling it on payments. And I just kept building the system. I was trying to copy what the banks were doing. And before I knew it, I was at about $9,000 a month consistently coming in just a very short amount of time, almost a year's time of building this business. And I wasn't taking any of the money because I still had my Army salary. I was just reinvesting. I had a 5-year plan and it worked out in 3. So I was only making about $4,500 a month in the military. And now I'm making $9,000 a month on land. Consistently every single month, I put in my resignation paperwork. They approved it, and I got out.
Fantastic. So, you would say, is it fair to say that kind of the thing that clicked was discovering the ability to make money in raw land was kind of like one of the bigger catalysts in that whole change? Like, because you said you had done some wholesaling, you did some rental properties, which are well and good. Whenever we talk about things that are, you know, a little bit different on any of these things, you know, I always try to tell people, you know, realize that everyone has their own reason for, you know, looking at a particular investment strategy. And, you know, this may or may not work for you. It may work wonders for you, but it's important to have the whole playbook. Because if you're running on a part of a playbook and you're only throwing passes the whole time, you forget about the run game and you'll get slaughtered. So, you know, would you say that kind of like discovering that was the big catalyst of saying, okay, hey, here's what works for me was kind of the big thing that, you know, really clicked then?
Yeah, that clicked because, you know, I sent out those postcards. If anybody wants a copy of that postcard, they can go to thelandsharks.com/postcard and get a copy of it and start sending them out. But yeah, it clicked because the phone started ringing and I was like, man, this is working. People are interested in hearing what I have to say. Started having meetings. And I found out these guys didn't want this land because I thought it was tax delinquent, but it was actually county held tax lien land, is land that no one would even pay the back taxes on it because it wasn't buildable. It wasn't accessible. It was landlocked. I mean, this was like very inefficient land, garbage in most people's eyes, but these guys that owned it were so far behind on taxes. Most of the time I ended up just paying the back taxes. It was all I could pay. And they received nothing. They just didn't want it. We call it the don't wanters. And I would remarket this stuff. One man's trash is another man's treasure. Kind of like a bicycle on the side of the road. You get that bicycle, you air the tires up, you shine it up, put a little WD-40 on the chain, and you can sell it for more. And that's all I did with the land. I just took photos of it and marketed it. And it clicked because it was working. It's like, holy crap, people want this stuff. Mm-hmm. Took photos and put it on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace and signs and, you know, neighbor letters. Like most of the time, the neighbors wanted to buy the land. It's nuts.
So these were, let's kind of get a little bit into the, you know, we've kind of touched on the why. Now let's look a little bit into the actual details of this. So you were mentioning that specifically, you were finding stuff, at least in the beginning, that was a lot of, you know, county delinquent taxes, meaning that the tax liens had been issued by the county. The owners didn't want to pay that, and they had been unable to sell the tax certificates at auction because no one was actually coming in and bidding on this. So you were kind of coming in and saying, hey, look, you know, this isn't selling at auction. And then were you negotiating directly with the county on some of these deals, or were you negotiating with the people? And, you know, that's something I'm not necessarily super familiar with, because I've done a bunch of tax certificate and tax deed auctions for clients, but rarely have I ever seen it come in when something hasn't sold. So let's talk a little bit about that, about how those kind of deals came to fruition when you have something that really no one else wants.
It was just the tax lien investors that didn't want it. So I did not negotiate with the county. Here's how the conversation went with the county. Hey, what amount do I need to pay to get this property out of tax lien certificate status? So it's no longer deed eligible. I'd figure that out. And then I'd go back to the sellers like, okay, here's the max I can pay for it. You owe $500 in taxes for the last 5 years. I think I can maybe give you about $300 for the land, or $500 or $1,000 for the land. Sometimes it's $3,000. It varied. Now I started that way, but you run out of those small deals really quick. And then it turned into $50,000 parcels. And like anybody listening to this is like, I don't have $50,000. Let me tell you, a lot of people do. And you can just sell your contract or assign your contract or wholesale that land. But yeah, there was no negotiation with the county. I probably should have tried. I really should have tried. But most of the time it was just like, hey, here's what I can pay. And most of the time these sellers were like, sure, yeah, that works for me. You know, I don't want the land. I inherited the land, or me and my wife bought the land 25 years ago. You know, things have changed. Life happened. We're now paying for college for 3 grandchildren, like you name it.
And would it be a fair kind of assessment on a lot of these deals? And one of the, maybe the nice things, especially when you're identifying stuff that's tax delinquent, is that because the only really encumbrance is the taxes, most of these things are owned free and clear. Otherwise, banks would have come in and done the foreclosure in first position. And then, you know, it wouldn't, you know, the banks would be on title indeed. It wouldn't necessarily be the people still owning it. So you have the kind of the added benefit of the only thing you're really dealing with is someone that owns it free and clear. They're getting kind of nominal bills, if you will, from the county on this stuff, and they just don't know necessarily what to do with it.
And for some people, those bills from that county is literally like nails on a chalkboard. That it's just like destroying them and keeping them awake at night. And they get our letter, they're like, oh my God, yes, take this land. Now let me just give this disclaimer. The tax delinquent land that I do is a very small percentage of my land business today. You know, we've definitely like, that's not all I buy. A lot of people focus on people that are tax delinquent out of state. Well, that's a very small list. Yes, you'll buy deals from that. I like to market anywhere there's demand for land. You know, you have some people pass away, some people inherit the land, some people are out of state, some people are out of the county. I've literally bought land where people lived in the county. They weren't behind on taxes. They just, you know, they bought it and the vision changed or the plans changed and they no longer want it. Like there's a huge bucket of people, and there's a tremendous amount of land out there available. If you ever drive across the United States, there's just unbelievable amounts of land out there. And, you know, there's not a lot of people going after it. Like not a lot of people talk. I mean, this is amazing cash cow business that no one's talking about.
Yeah. And I think a little bit of that, and, you know, I'm always happy to kind of admit when, you know, my personal philosophy doesn't align necessarily with my guests. I really like cash flow investing. You know, so that means that things that, you know, you can kind of have a cash flow centric mindset on. And granted, you could certainly, it sounds like you've definitely built a business to generate that cash flow, talking about the $9,000 a month that you've generated from it. But a lot of people look at raw land, and unless there's things like timber rights or mineral rights or hunting rights or something on it, it's not necessarily a cash flow play. It's more of a, you know, flip, wholesale, you know, kind of an exit strategy plan for the most part in it. So, you know, looking at that specifically, especially in the context of what's out there, I think it's important to understand that, you know, you can definitely be successful with this and generate a cash flowing business. I kind of want to talk to you about that a little bit after a few questions I have for you. But specifically for this, you know, and especially for our listeners, and I'm located in Florida, you know, 90% or maybe more of the population lives within like 15 miles of the coastline. If you ever have the distinct pleasure of driving across the middle of the state of Florida, there's not much there. Let me tell you that much. It's a lot of, it's so desolate that there's sod farms. They just grow grass. It's just fields of grass and oranges and tomatoes. So there's a lot of raw land out there. Even if you are in a very high population density area, you know, you don't necessarily have to drive too far. I think it's something like 75% of the entire U.S. population lives within 30 miles of the coast. So fourth largest country on the planet. There's a bunch of land there. So I think it's important to illustrate specifically for people that do live in high population density centers that there's plenty of this out there. Now, you know, you're identifying, you know, there has to be a need in any time that you're identifying things to buy, you know, whether it's tax delinquent properties or people that just want to get out of it, that needs some type of exit strategy. You know, if someone loves the asset and they're really happy with it, they're not going to sell it to you. So you're identifying needs of these people, but you also have to identify your exit for it. You know, maybe they don't want it, but you're not necessarily going to go in there and buy something that's, you know, a Superfund site. You're not buying waterfront on Love Canal. You know, you want to be buying something that has some type of exit strategy. So what are some things that you look at specifically with raw land that are attractive to you? I'm sure there's probably a spectrum of things, whether it's you think that it's in the path of progress or that there's, you know, going to be, you know, something coming in or, you know, X, Y, and Z. Let's talk a little bit about the strategy on, you know, besides just identifying the people wanting to get rid of this stuff, of what your kind of strategy is on the back end. And I'm sure it's deal specific. You know, the tax delinquent stuff's going to have a different strategy than the $50,000, the $200,000 parcels of land. Let's go in a little bit about the strategy on that.
Yeah, now it's changed really. It used to be cheap land. It used to be in my county. And now I do it all virtually. I'm in a very expensive county, and you probably are too, as well, since you say you're in Florida. I don't do a lot of land deals in my county these days. Now it just, I look for areas of demand. I want to see land selling. That's it. I want to see land selling because it makes my life very easy to figure out what it's selling for. I can comp it in 5 or 10 minutes max, and they're guaranteed wins because I'm buying them at discount. And if I'm not buying them at discount, I need to have some type of value play, whether it be, you know, subdivide or add fences and gutters and whatnot, but I don't do a lot of that. You know, the most I do sometimes, the other day, I have a couple parcels of land, that we bought in Florida. They're 4 acres. The roads, like, you couldn't get to them. Like, and I mean, God bless the settlers that came across Florida, before there was paved roads, because let me tell you, like, before the sod farms were there, that was like grown up forest. So I had to pay a mulcher, a guy with a machine, to go and mulch the roads that were the county proposed that were there that just didn't exist. Now people can get to them. He mulched. We didn't cut down any trees, but like a lot of vines and weeds and just high. Well, I guess there would have been some trees, but, you know, that's about the most I do to these parcels of land. So to answer your question, Alex, just straight up, I like to see land selling, demand, supply, demand. I want to go in, find demand. Once I see where the demand's happening, I figure out how to price it out, what it's worth, what it's selling for per square foot or per acre. And then I make a very I make a consistent series of offers. I call my land offer letters, my LOLs. And if anybody wants a copy of that, just go to thelandsharks.com/LOL, which I've been having a little issues with that technology. So if you don't get it, just email me. I'll send you an email. I'm not just trying to take your email because I can care less. I want to make sure I can help people. I'm not going to spam you or anything. But anyhow, I send these land offer letters out. Say, for instance, Alex, you got a piece of land. It's going for $100,000 an acre. I send you an offer for $57,500 an acre. If you accept it, you sign it, you send it back. I look at the land deal. I said, yep, I can definitely buy this and resell it. And I want the real estate agents to help me sell it. Now, when I was just starting out, I didn't have the money to buy these more expensive parcels of land. So I'd get them under contract, like with a purchase agreement. And then I would do something called wholesaling or assignment of contract. And wholesalers get a bad rap. Oh, it doesn't take any credit or time or money. That's all a boatload of BS. It does take credit. It does take time. It does take money. My credit is where I was funding the the letters with my American Express. And then I get them under contract, and then I'd have to go out and figure out who is buying these 1 acre parcels for all cash in the last 6 months. And there's systems and programs you can do that with. So I would look up, I would almost reverse engineer who's buying it, and then reach out to the ABC home buyers or ABC home builders or John Buys Land and say, hey, I got a piece of land. It's worth $100,000. I got it under contract for super cheap. was wondering if you wanted to pay me, $75,000 for it. You'd have a $25,000 discount. I got it under contract for $65,000. I'm not telling him that. I'd make a quick $10,000 cash, have maybe 2 hours wrapped up in that deal, $5,000 an hour. I mean, not a bad day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it kind of brings up something that, is always interesting, especially in, things like this is, developing your systems. I'm kind of a systems nerd with this kind of thing. And there's two general ways that I see a lot of people go. You can't have one without the other. But would you say that kind of once you, the tax and liquid stuff, I'm assuming, was a lot of just, your own personal, time equity in, the granular research of finding the stuff, going through tax rolls and things like that. But as you started to develop this, did you find that it was more focused on the personal relationships that you built with let's say realtors or developers in a certain area, or was it more systems driven? What was kind of the mixture of the both was saying, okay, let's say I built out a system, I have an API to identify, my certain factors that I'm looking for in an area, because you can't scale anything without, kind of having both. You have 24 hours in a day. And let's say you have 12 workable ones to call people where they're not angry that you're calling during dinner. So, what kind of things did you kind of develop that helped you scale this effectively?
Yeah.
Maybe also talk about a few things, a few stumbling blocks you had along the way as well.
Yeah, great question, Alex. And I want to caution people on scale because I scaled. I had 15 team members, bought the office, had the best coffee, the cleaning service, all these things. And you have a couple slow months and your expenses keep going out the window and your income stays the same or goes down. Scaling is dangerous. So I have a very small team now. I have an executive assistant. I have an accountant. I have a part-time acquisition manager and myself. Very simple. And my system in place was, every single day, we go and find areas of demand and we send out letters, consistently. It's like priming that old red farmhouse pump. Once you get that air out of the line, you have water. And you just can't stop pumping it because the water will stop when you stop pumping it. You got to either pay someone to pump it for you or put a machine on it. So we go in these areas and we consistently mail them. Someday they'll do a deal with us. It could take a few mailings. It could be the first one. A lot of people get hung up on that. I sent out all these letters and no one called. Well, send them again. Because guess what? You could send me a few emails. I think Brianna, your assistant, emailed me a couple times. When I saw the third one, God bless her for sending the third one. And so you just got to be consistent because people don't see the first one. And same thing with my mailbox. I'll go out there and check it from time to time and I'll look for the handwritten letters and everything else goes back in the mailbox because I know my wife will come behind me in a couple of days and get it. Or sometimes the mail guy, it gets too full and he brings it to the front door. So, you just got to be consistent. So that's the system. And yeah, the relationships come into play. But when you're just starting out, no one knows you from Adam. No one cares. You got a few seconds to get the attention of someone. Because most people when you call them or they get the letter, and 1 second they're wondering, so what? How can this help me? How can this help my life? My marriage is in the garbage, or I've got a drinking problem, or my children are mad at me, or the dog just pooped on the floor, or I got to go to work again and work for the boss that treats me like garbage. How can you help someone? If you can remember that in marketing and business. Is you got a few seconds to help someone out. That's why I asked you at the beginning of this podcast, Alex, who cares about my bio? It's so what, how can you help me today?
Exactly. Yeah. It's, we live in a results driven world, which isn't a horrible thing. But there's things that go into that. It's not, you don't build results on, a cloud of air. There has to be a developed pyramid that supports that top end result. Driven nature that we all, everyone, you can have everything in the world, but if you don't actually have the ability to support yourself, whatever that means to you, whether that's, an extra $3,000 a month, or that's $9,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a month, you have to have something to support that. So I think we've kind of covered a good amount of content, at least on specifically, how you got started, kind of where you've gone now, at least specifically in, looking at areas of demand, how you are looking to exit these, there's the wholesaling factor. But what are some of the other factors that you look for in the exits of these? Because, you mentioned that you have, X amount of, just using the number, you know, when you got to that $9,000 of cash flow, was that strictly just on, was that, you know, substantive of wholesaling? Was that, you know, certain deals that you had made with cash flow? Was that, you know, selling these things on other financing, or a combination of everything? So let's kind of, again, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, you know, the mechanics of this and how it kind of works for people.
It was owner financing. Yeah, it was seller, me being the seller and financing, becoming the bank and letting, say, Alex, I bought this piece of land. I paid $15,000 for it. I'm selling it for $45,000. I'm selling it for exactly what it's worth. I'm not marking it up. I'm selling it for exactly what it's worth. Technically, I am marking it up from what I bought it for, but it doesn't matter what I bought it for. I would have buyers come to me sometimes. Well, I see you only paid $15,000. You know, what justifies you selling it for $45,000? I say, because that's what the market says it's worth. You can buy mine or buy someone else's. But here's also the thing is I offer seller financing. So I bought it for $15,000. I'm marketing it for $45,000 because that's what everyone else is. That's what all the other acres are selling for out here, for $45,000. And I'm looking for a down payment of $15,000. So you pay me $15,000 down. I get all my money back out of the deal. Title company does the paperwork. Now I hold a mortgage and the first lien position on that land. And you're going to pay me $250 a month for the next 30 years at 12% interest. Or you can pay it off early, no prepayment penalties, no balloon payments. That's where the consistent monthly payment. Now, how I built that $9,000 a month, like within a very short amount of time, back then I was only doing like 24-month loans. So people would pay me like $500, $600, $700, sometimes $1,500 a month. So it only took a few land deals to do that, like 10 or 12 land deals. Now, doing this for since 2015, almost 9 years now, and I'm a practitioner. I still do land deals every single week. I've learned that I want to stretch out those payments longer because when they pay off, it's kind of a celebration, but also it's a sad day because I just reduce my monthly income. So I started looking at what the banks are doing. They do a lot of 30-year mortgages, right? And I mean, many years ago, back in 2013, the average mortgage was just $200,000. $200,000 mortgage. Average interest rate was 6%. So you're paying, what, $1,200 a month for 30 years. You pay back $420,000 over the life of that loan. That's not really 6%. They're figuring that 6% on the amount of payment on that balance that you originally took out. And you're also, the banks knew that people move every 5 to 7 years. So the first 7 years of a fully amortized mortgage is front-end loaded interest. So if people pay me for 5 or 6 or 7 years on a piece of land and then pay it off, or they get a bank loan and build a house on it or a cabin, I just collected a boatload of interest, absolutely boatload of interest. And the mortgages are run off of amortization schedules. So I really just copied what the banks were doing. That's all. I didn't create this. And people love it. Americans think, how much money is it going to cost me each month? How much is this going to cost me each month? Not what's the total cost of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, always kind of good to look at, you know, what is the social norm of what you're doing? You know, people, I think, tend to discount that because they're like, oh, well, you know, there's so much, you know, saturation in this one market. Well, if you can bring a service to a market that, you know, everyone, you know, I think everyone loves to complain about the Walmarts out there, you know, think about your Wells Fargo's and everything. It's like, oh, I wish we had the corner store that I could go down and get something from. Well, if you can bring that same kind of human interaction to people. And I would wager to guess that the people that are looking for raw land are more kind of in line with that mentality. You know, they like that little more hometown feel, that like that corner store vibe, if you will, to the transactions that they do. So again, I might be completely off the mark, but knowing the people I've known, I, you know, grew up in rural Florida for the first part of my life. I know people that like raw land, and those are the kind of people we're typically talking about. Not to say other people don't do it, but I would think that you're kind of playing to the market with saying, hey, look, you know, I have this piece of property. You know, you can do with what you want to with it. And like you said, things like cabins, you know, small homes, maybe bringing in a trailer or something is kind of attractive to the, you know, raw land market. Yes. And being able to deal directly with the person selling it and then having them finance it is probably pretty attractive. Not to say they couldn't qualify for loans for other stuff, but I would imagine, maybe you can speak to this a little bit. What does the market look like for more conventional financing from the big banks on raw land? Is it harder to get people if they want to come in and buy it? Is it harder for the big banks, for them to get the big bank financing so you have a good niche in that? Or is it more of the mentality of the people buying it that just like the owner financing?
Yeah, banks really don't finance land. There's a few like Mid-Florida Credit Union, Florida Bank. They'll do lot loans. I think you have to come up with anywhere from 20 to 50% down minimum. I believe it's 20% down. I've never done a loan through them. And then it's you're preparing to build on it one day. So that's one of the few banks. Farm Credit, if you're going to farm on the land. But that's those are really the only few that I know about. So a lot of banks, no, it's very hard. Like when my parents bought their land, they had to put 50% down. They bought 21 acres out in Florida. They had to put 50% down, and I believe they ended up using like a lot of equity that they already had in their home. So it was like more of a bridge slash construction loan. So yeah, I don't see too many people getting loans on land, and I've been in the land business since for 9 years now.
Gotcha. And so with, you know, that said of, you know, we're talking about kind of how people are financing this kind of stuff, you know, let's talk about, you know, specifically you're talking about having, you know, let's say $9,000 a month in, you know, cash flows that gets you to, you know, $108,000 a year, assuming that you have no expenses and everything. And you're talking about buying, you know, let's say $50,000 parcels of land. It begs the question of, you know, okay, great. You know, I understand kind of now how we are going to go out and find this stuff. And, you know, the tax delinquent stuff being so cheap, you know, maybe you have enough saved up to take that down yourself. But you have to have money on your side of things to be able to, you know, acquire these things.
Yeah.
And while $108,000 a year is awesome, I mean, that's a great milestone to hit on just, you know, I hate the term, but it works. Mailbox money, if you will.
Yeah.
Stuff that's just coming into you. I'm not a big fan of the kitsch terms, but, you know, when they work, they work. So let's talk a little bit about how you go out and you acquire financing for these things. You know, are you using owner financing for these people? What are some sources that you go out and, you know, build that network of people that want to invest with you? Because specifically on the, you know, IRA custodial side of things that we do at Advanta, I'm sure most people that have been following the podcast know we, you know, the adjunct to this is that we're self-directed IRA custodians, alternative asset custodians. We see a lot of people lending money out of their IRAs. It's a popular thing to do. But, you know, not that we have to focus on that by any stretch of the imagination, but where do you find success in how you are, you know, getting the capital in to fund these deals? And what do those kind of terms look like for you?
No, I love that you asked that, Alex. And when I started in 2015, 2016, I absolutely had no money, no savings account. I was negative. Because I owed American Express and Capital One, and my bank or my my Home Depot card was maxed out. Because I had purchased a bunch of rentals over the years too that were just keeping me down. Honestly, all my Army discretionary income went to it. Now, granted, I'm finally 9 years later digging myself. I dug myself out of that hole, and these houses are paid down and they're worth a fortune now, but I didn't see that at the time. I was like, oh my God, I can never quit my job with this rental. It's just sucking the life out of me. But now it's like I have so much equity in these things, which I get the cash flow. But anyhow, I built up that cash flow well over $9,000 a month now, consistently coming in from just land payments. I flexed into the more in-demand land because realtors now are beating down my door to sell this land for me. And when I buy them at such, like, you know, less than 50 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar, I'm in a really good position. But you're right. I can only do so much with my cash flow. And I don't care who you are. Everyone runs out of money if you are consistently buying and kind of just greasing the wheels and feeding the tank. So I love working with people that have, and I use my IRA. I actually took it from the military and converted it to a self-directed. But I love working with people that have those, and they're earning like 4, 5, 6% in the market. Usually I'm paying them anywhere from 9, 10, 11, 12%. And it's secured by a piece of land that we're buying at 50, 60 cents on the dollar. That way that my lender's in a good position. So I call them my lenders. They're my private capital lenders. Like, I just did a deal with my neighbor. You know, he lent me $115,000. The land was worth about $230,000. So he's at a 50% loan to value. We get a lender's title insurance policy to protect him. We record that mortgage and that promissory note in the first, he's in the first lien holder position. So if I get hit by a bus, he gets, well, the land's for sale anyways, but he takes the land, you know, if God forbid I don't pay him, which there's things set up in place for that. But yeah, that's how it works out. So perfect example, my mother-in-law and my father-in-law, they lent me about $40,000 at 9% interest. Their payment is $800 a month for 5 years, fully amortized. And I resold that land that we bought for $40,000 for $91,000. And he's going to pay me for 13 and a half years at 12% interest. So, and he also gave me a $5,000 down payment. So how that works is I put $5,000 in my pocket. My bank, my in-laws, they were my bank, they're my lender. They funded the deal. And then now this buyer is paying $946 a month to me every month. And if he doesn't pay me, I still got to pay my in-laws, my lender. And they get $800 a month. So I'm keeping the difference of $146 a month. Not a huge amount, but it's not like having a rental. I'm never going to have a repair on this vacant raw land. And mm-hmm. that's for 5 years. And after that 5 years, he still owes me $946 a month for about whatever. What's 13 minus 5? I'm not good at public math, by the way. It's when I was up there at the whiteboard, the chalkboard as a kid, I got the problem wrong and I got laughed at. So long story short, that buyer is going to keep paying me for several more years. I'm going to do over $102,000 net profit, plus my in-laws are making interest on their money, and we'll put it back to work on another parcel of land. So I do this with private lenders. It's absolutely incredible to do that. I mean, it's a win-win-win. Like, we helped out the lady that sold us the land because her husband passed away. We helped the buyer out because we're offering financing, and we sold him what it's worth. My in-laws are happy because they're making interest, and I'm happy because I just did a land deal with like none of my own money.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's kind of, again, to bring it full circle, because I always feel like it needs so much more context when people, like, you can invest in real estate with none of your own money. And, you know, being in, you know, real estate and alternative investments for as long as I have since, the beginning of 2012, you know, I get asked the question. I was like, well, is that even true? I'm like, yes, but it's not necessarily just like as easy as, you know, the TikToker makes it seem. You know, there's a lot of things that go into it. There's a lot of trust and systems and things that you have to build up for that to be an attainable scenario. Is it possible? Absolutely. Can almost anyone do it? Sure. If you have, you know, the mentality and the gumption, if you will, to actually go out and, you know, do it in good faith. You know, you really need to kind of understand what goes into something like that.
You know what the hardest part about that whole deal for me was just asking my father-in-law if he wanted to do a real estate deal with me, because I almost felt like I was like begging. Now I'm like, I love talking to other people about using their money because it's helping them too. I've got a system. It's really good. And I built up trust, you know, and that was the hardest thing, was like getting out of my own way, asking my father-in-law. That was a little nerve-wracking. You know,
yeah,
having that conversation.
And asking people for money is always a tough thing. Whether it's, you know, asking a father-in-law for money can certainly make for an awkward Thanksgiving dinner. So you have that kind of other component to it. But asking anyone for money, especially if it's someone that you don't know from Adam and it's a very new relationship, is always tough. And it kind of leads me into, you know, the next question that I kind of formulated, is that what are some things that, you know, you do, especially, because I'm sure you have kind of a formula. Don't give away the secret sauce by any means. But
no, I'm here to tell it, man.
When you go in and you want to make this an attractive offer for someone, especially when you're trying to acquire that financing, do you like to come in and say, hey, look, you know, here's what we need. You know, you obviously have kind of the prospectus that you can say, hey, you know, here's kind of what we do. Here's our strategy. You know, here's the amount of time, you know, the periodization of the loan. Are you someone that likes to say, hey, you know, we give points up front? Do you like to go with a slightly larger interest rate? You know, what are some things that you like to, you know, that you find work well for the raw land space that make it attractive for someone to come in? Because, you know, you're not just going to go say, hey, I'll give you 50% interest if you lend me money. You know, not to be hyperbolic with the example, but, you know, there's probably some things that you come in initially and say, hey, look, you know, besides the fact that I'm good at what I do, here's some things that make this an attractive investment for you as well.
Yeah, I don't sell them on it. I just say, look, you want to earn 9, 10, 12% interest on your money. Here's what I would pay you over a year. Here's the land deal. It's worth about $50,000. I'm buying it for $25,000. I'm looking for $25,000. If you need to see proof of funds, I'll show you my bank accounts over here, showing you I can cover this loan for many, many years to come. And I'm going to sell it on seller financing. So really, I asked three questions. How much money do you have? What are you currently earning with your money? Like what interest rate? And then, you know, what would put a big smile on your face? So it's technically four questions to see per annum as far as interest rate. And then number four is how long do you want this money to work for you? And I pay all the fees, you know, and sometimes like, you know, depending on the land deal, what interest rate I can pay. But, you know, I like to marry the deal to my private capital lender. And what I think what works amazing is I show them proof like, listen, I could buy this thing with my own cash. But here's the thing. I run off a system called Profit First because I've been through ups and downs in real estate. You know, I've been scathed a few times. So I know that the more cash I have in my accounts, the better I can run my business for longer periods of time, because sometimes there's feasts, sometimes there's famine, sometimes you get a $120,000 IRS tax bill. So you just need to know about these things.
Yeah. And that's always a good point too. And kind of coming back, you know, it's a nice way to bring it full circle is that, you know, just because you have good cash flow built up, you don't, you know, most people, and again, always have to make the attorney overlords happy. I can't give tax, financial, or legal advice, but generally speaking, in a very broad terminology, just because you have X amount of money coming in, you don't want to have that same X going out. You know, you want to keep cash reserves. So just because you have this money to buy something cash, why not necessarily be able to generate more cash flow, more deals by using other people's money, have them get a benefit from it, have them make some more money? Because everyone, the nice thing about real estate is everyone can eat. You know, the realtor can eat, the investor can eat, the lender can eat, the end buyer can eat. Everyone can come to the table and get a good meal on this stuff. It's not just one person, you know, Scrooge McDucking into a big pile of gold coins. There's a lot of different ways for everyone to enjoy the benefit of this. And, you know, it's something I'm passionate about. I don't think any one person should hold the entire keys to the kingdom. And real estate specifically offers that avenue of success to so many different people. And again, kind of going back to it, is that just because you have this cash flow coming in doesn't mean you can't cut out of the people in on the deal. You can't make a great living at it as well. So coming up on kind of the end of the podcast here, we like to kind of package these things into 45 minutes. I think we've gotten a lot of great content here. Is there anything that we specifically haven't covered that you feel is kind of a passion point for you in raw land investing? I think we've, you know, certainly covered, you know, the viability of it as an investment, you know, kind of the avenues to look at for finding this stuff, whether it's, you know, on the small end of getting started with tax delinquency, or then looking for larger pieces that are in, you know, quote, paths of progress or development, and looking for actual sales in a certain area. And then also covering kind of the acquisition side on, you know, how you find the money, how you retail these things out, where the money comes in, goes out, and builds this, you know, builds this pyramid of success. What are some things that we maybe haven't covered that you'd like to make sure people take away from this when it comes to raw land investing?
Man, I think we've covered so much. If people want to find out more, you know, research me, Brent L. Bowers. I'm always talking about this, but I love how you said, you know, all the people that are involved in this, these transactions, there's so many, it takes a village. It really does. You know, anybody's just looking to get started, just do that first deal, you know, do your homework, the best you can. But again, you know, don't let paralysis, set in with all of your analysis. You know, at the end of the day, like, you know, most good things happen. And it's like, I look at the, yeah, I'll leave one thing. The last thing is, you know, I look at things a little differently when I look at opportunities is, you know, a lot of people like look at everything that can go wrong. And yes, you want to know those things. Like, you don't want to go into anything blind, but I like to look at the other side of the coin is, what if I don't do it? What's going to, like, what's 5 years later going to look like? Mm-hmm. You know, what's like, what am I going to miss out on? Or what, like, you know, if I don't do this opportunity, will it change my life type thing? So many people look at like what bad can happen. Well, let's look at all the good things that can happen, because most of the time the bad things don't happen. Like, you hear these stories. I've done over 350 real estate transactions. I got sued finally. I finally got sued by a realtor that I text three text messages and one cold call. I had a system that we were marketing like crazy. And there's these marketers that say, if you haven't made anybody mad by 10 a.m., then you're not doing it right. Well, I took that to full heart. And this guy, he was a professional litigator. He went after people like me, sued me. I fought. I should have just settled with him. But hey, the cost of doing business. And thank God that didn't happen on my first deal. It was on my like 250th, and it was a write-off. I still had to pay the IRS that year, so I didn't even have enough write-offs. He was a write-off. it was like I thought I was going to win the court battle, and it was all virtuals during COVID. And when that judge put that amount that I had to pay, I was just like, unbelievable. Like, yeah. So it happens. Things happen. But it didn't kill me.
Yeah, you always have to look at the cost of action and also the cost of inaction when it comes to, looking at all these things. So I think that's a great way to end it off. Brent, I really do appreciate you being on with us today, because the most valuable resource any of us have is our time, and we can't make any more of it. So thanks for taking the time out of your day to spend some with us. Again, this has been the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. My name is Alex Perney. Thanks for being with us today, and we'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage Podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at advantaira.com and subscribe.